I'm Greya, and this is The Climate Question, where we ask simply, what on earth can we do about climate change? Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
Hi, I'm Helen Lewis, and I want to tell you about a podcast I've made for BBC Radio 4 and BBC Sounds. It's called The New Gurus, and it's about how everywhere you look on the internet, people are giving advice. Advice they claim will transform your life. Advice that gets them thousands, even millions of devoted followers. These online prophets are telling us how to eat, how to think, how to get rich, how to find love, how to manage our time. So how exactly are these gurus changing our lives and the world around us? And who holds them to account? Find out by subscribing to The New Gurus wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Neil Rozelle.
And I'm Kate Lamble.
Every week we ask you to email us at theclimatequestion@bbc.com, and some of you have responded. Seems there's something on your collective mind.
Our inbox is full of messages like this.
Hi, my name is Andrea, I'm from Germany, and my climate question is, considering it's mainly human activities driving up the CO2 numbers, wouldn't the planet be better off with less humans?
Rob in Australia wrote to say, I had a quick look through the list of podcasts and couldn't find one focusing on the problem of human overpopulation. He says it must be front and center in any discussion about climate change.
And I chatted to a guy we're calling Simon in the north of England.
I've got one of your emails in front of me here, and in that email you called population the elephant in the room. Why do you think it feels like the elephant in the room?
Because you hear next to no mention of the subject, which to me is the never-ending driving force behind climate change. It stands to reason that if there were significantly fewer humans on the planet, those carbon dioxide emissions would also reduce.
There's a lot to get into here. You guys are setting the agenda this week.
What does population have to do with climate change?
It's actually quite contentious.
This is The Climate Question from the BBC World Service.
Okay, so I'm in this beautiful medieval city called Old Delhi. I'm standing on top of an old building right at the heart of the city, just to give you a feel of how old Delhi looks.
Standing over the Indian capital for us, Rajesh Joshi, a veteran journalist and professor.
So I see a sea of humanity flowing down the overcrowded street. You know, the rickshaw pullers, the pushcart drivers, sundry shoppers and beggars, everyone jostling for space under a crisscrossing mesh of tangled electric wire cables overhead.
Rajesh has watched the city change.
I came to this city as a job seeker in the mid-1980s, and the total population of Delhi back then was just about 8 million. Since then, it has increased more than three times. Currently, it's, if I'm not wrong, 30 million. The city has grown and expanded beyond imagination.
Delhi's at the sharp end of the global population boom.
In my lifetime, the planet has gone from 4 to almost 8 billion people.
And remind us, Neil, that's 70, 75 years?
Yeah. Try less than 50, cheeky monkey.
Sorry. So how does this factor into climate change?
Population is an important part of the equation.
Who's joining us there, Professor?
That is my dog, Yogi.
Hello, Yogi. Welcome to The Climate Question.
Her ears are perked up. She's listening.
Oh, we love you, Yogi.
She usually never, ever barks, but I'm not sure why she's barking right now.
She has something to add, clearly.
Yes.
Yogi is a mix of Chihuahua and Rat Terrier. Her human is Anu Ramaswamy, a professor of civil and environmental engineering at Princeton University in the US.
Can you help us with a simple definition of what do we mean when we talk about overpopulation?
Well, it turns out it's not such a simple definition. Overpopulation is actually a difficult word to understand and unpack. Overpopulation is saying that our planet has finite resources, finite capacity to absorb pollution, and heat warming gases. We can't have always growing populations on a finite planet. We're going to hit against planetary limits.
This idea that humans will hit a limit can feel intuitive, almost logical, which perhaps explains why concerns about the size of the population are older than Neil.
If we scroll way back through the climate question email box, there's one from 1798 from a guy called Thomas Malthus. This father of three believed humans were doomed. The population, he thought, would always grow faster than farmers' ability to feed it.
Only that didn't happen. Food production has always kept up. But despite Malthus's ideas being proven wrong again and again over centuries, they remain part of the debate. Students of demography and economics are still told to read his papers today.
And if we look at a place like Malawi in southern Africa, it's easy to see why ideas of overpopulation persist.
Dr. Niavani Madise is with the African Institute of Development Policy.
The growth rate is around 2.6, 2.7% per annum. So that means that every 25 years, the population doubles itself.
Wow, that seems like a huge rate of expanse. Do you notice that difference in Malawi?
Oh, yes. When I was a young girl, you'd go around, very few cars on the roads. And also you go to the market, very few people. Now, you go to the market, it's so crowded and, so much traffic jam. You definitely feel the difference.
Echoes of Delhi there in Lilongwe. Niavani says she's seen forests cleared to create more space, rivers polluted with sewage, and...
My understanding from those who do agricultural research as well is that the soil fertility has diminished because in the past what would happen is that people would use a piece of land, grow their crops, and leave one other piece idle to replenish. Now people don't have that luxury.
Urban crowding, rural ruin. In places, the number of people might put pressure on the environment.
But is it a climate problem?
There's no direct relationship between population and greenhouse gas emissions. The relationship comes when we consider the consumption of people around the world.
Arvind Ravikumar is a professor of energy transition and climate policy at the University of Texas.
One of our listeners has written, wouldn't fewer people mean lower emissions?
Fewer people might mean fewer emissions, but emissions are not equally distributed around the globe. People in the Western world consume far more than people in sub-Saharan Africa or in Asia. I'll give you an example. Ethiopia, on a per capita basis, consumes 100 times less than what US emits in terms of carbon emissions.
Last year, the charity Oxfam published a report which found the richest 1% of the world's population produced more emissions than the poorest 50% put together.
And therefore, when we talk about population, we cannot pretend that everybody consumes equally and everybody emits equally. There are parts of the world where emissions are significantly concentrated compared to other regions in the world. In fact, recent analyses have shown that even if the population in low-income countries increased by a couple billion, it will add very little to global carbon emissions.
A couple of billion, and it has little impact.
Yeah.
What he's saying is kind of astonishing, right? 2 billion people is, to say the least, a lot. It's the combined population of Europe and Africa.
He's crunched the numbers and found that an extra 2 billion low-income people, as defined by the World Bank, these are people without cars, without electricity often, would see global emissions rise by just 1.5%.
Add 2 billion high-income earners, that's people with cars and power and all the mod cons, and Arvind reckons emissions would rise by more than 60%.
So when it comes to climate change and population, where you were born matters.
That's not just true between nations, it's true within them as well.
I've come to a cluster of shanties where primarily working-class people live. They are daily wage earners. And I met Muhammad Anis and his family.
Here he is. He lives with his wife and 5 kids.
The entire family earns $2 per day. So I asked him this question. What was the thinking behind having so many children? He had this stock answer that it's God's grace. It's in God's hand, it's not in my hand.
The family struggles to feed itself. They have no electricity. Their carbon footprint is almost zero.
But less than a kilometer away.
In New Delhi, you have broad roads, shopping arcades, modern shopping malls, high-rise buildings, plush neighborhoods like Golf Links and Greater Kailash and what you have, where the cities high and mighty live. I know families who don't need even two cars. They have three or four or five cars, one for the son, one for the daughter-in-law, and for husband and wife, separate cars.
And I suppose the family with five cars also have air conditioning.
Oh, air conditioning is everywhere. Air conditioning is even in now middle-class, lower-middle-class houses in Delhi. People have two or three or four air conditioners. They say, we can't live in Delhi without air conditioning.
Outside these big, cool homes, he says, delivery boys are constantly arriving with parcels filled by online retailers.
We talk about overpopulation, but there's also this concept of overconsumption. Overconsumption is definitely an important piece of the puzzle that can't be ignored.
Anu Ramaswamy is an engineer, so naturally she likes to solve puzzles with equations. She works with one developed in the 1970s. It states that human impact equals population multiplied by affluence, multiplied by the efficiency of the technology our societies produce and use.
All these factors play a role, but Anu's part of a group of international scientists which regularly tries to break down how much population contributes when it comes to emissions.
Versus changes in affluence and consumption in that same period of time, versus technologies in that same period of time.
Now, don't worry, Neil, this isn't a test. The maths has been done for you. 2 years ago, these calculations produced a surprising conclusion.
For the first time, if you look at the whole globe, affluence has superseded the impact of population change. And that's the key complexity, that affluence, the way we're consuming, and the inequality in consumption are really driving the environmental impact.
This is really interesting. It marks a global shift.
So this is our dining.
Rajesh Joshi saw it firsthand when he went into one of those fancy New Delhi homes.
Yeah, it's a huge kitchen, so it has to house a lot of stuff, so it's huge. And we had the space to have it huge.
So I'm Preeti Dargan. I'm 46 years old, a mother, a housewife, and complete socialite.
Let's talk about your house, your dining room, your drawing room. It's very beautiful and very tastefully done up. So how many people live in this house?
My husband, I, and my daughter. That's it. And we have some house help.
How many of them?
So we have about three of them live in. And to clean this whole house, we need a lot of staff. So we have to hire some temporary help as well.
Geographically, we're not that far from the slums of Old Delhi, where people are struggling to feed themselves. But we might as well be worlds apart.
I love shopping. So online is great, and I love going to the malls as well.
Why do you love shopping? Why do you love accumulating things which you don't need?
I need everything that I buy. You cannot be judgmental about anybody's needs. And I derive a lot of happiness out of being very, very drawn towards consumer things. And I love it. And I'm not apologetic about it.
So if I tell you that poor people have a smaller carbon footprint as compared to their richer counterparts, do you feel apologetic about it?
So the brain says, yes, we should be apologetic about it, but the heart does not agree. Yes, poor can't afford lots of stuff, so their carbon imprint is small. But here, my heart wins over my brain because it gives me happiness.
I think we should say thank you here to Preeti for being so honest.
We should also say that while Preeti's carbon footprint may be on the larger side, she's just been consuming
and finding happiness
in a way that people in the West have been doing for decades.
Climate change has not happened because population in the developing world is high. Climate change is happening because of over 100 years of unabated carbon emissions from the developed world. That is the root cause of the problem, and that's what we need to solve.
So Arvind Ravikumar says Western countries, where consumption has long been high, have an historic responsibility to bring down emissions. And yet, he says, people from the West keep bringing up the question of population, not consumption.
Take famous figures like the British naturalist David Attenborough, saying things like,
in the long run, population growth has to come to an end.
Or statements like the one published in the journal Bioscience in 2019, which was signed by 11,000 scientists and warned of untold suffering as a result of the climate crisis.
It included statements like, the world population must be stabilized and ideally gradually reduced.
I was shocked. I was shocked that 11,000 people could read what was written on that document and sign their names to it. In fact, I talk about it in my class, an example of how not to talk about addressing climate change. If you look around the world, majority of the countries with high population growth rates are now in Asia and Africa. And so when people talk about reducing population or addressing population, they're specifically referring to addressing population and reducing population of Black and brown people.
Niavani Madise says she's attended conferences with academics from around the world where discussions about population and the climate have been tense.
There used to be a blame game. So you would have the rich countries saying, oh, Africa, your population is too high. And then we had the Africans going saying, yeah, but you are emitting too much by way of greenhouse gases because of your consumption patterns. And because of that, population conferences would be the sort of places where people were ready to argue and not very productive.
With all this in mind, you might be surprised to hear that Malawi, a country the World Bank calls one of the poorest in the world, where personal emissions are nearly 20 times lower than the average American's.
Malawi mentions population in its official climate plans.
What Malawi is saying is we need to find ways of reducing the rapid population growth, and we can do that using voluntary methods. So making sure that those who need access to contraception have it, making sure that we provide enough information for adolescent girls so they understand, and when they start experimenting with sex, then they can actually be supported to make sure that they do not have an unintended pregnancy.
How does this connect to climate change if Malawi is such a tiny player in terms of emissions?
Okay, so we are tiny in terms of emissions, but then we suffer the consequences. So we get a lot of heavy rains, 1 year sometimes too much rain, then our crops are destroyed. Or we have too hot, as at the moment we're experiencing extreme heat wave, which is not good for the crops, but also more importantly, not good for our health.
We've heard again and again that developing countries need money to cope with extreme weather brought by climate change.
Money to support their healthcare systems or rebuild roads which may have been swept away. But Niavani says slowing population growth could help too.
Smaller families tend to be richer and have the savings to rebuild when something goes wrong, which in turn takes the pressure off the government.
So slowing the population growth isn't necessarily about emissions, about mitigating climate change from happening, but it's about adapting, about living with the changing climate.
Exactly. Exactly. It's about adapting.
Global birth rates have been declining since the 1970s. As countries get richer, families tend to have fewer children.
India's total fertility rate is currently very close to what's called the replacement rate, what it would take for the population to stabilise, although it will need to stay there for a couple of decades before the growth stops completely.
But as we've heard, in climate terms, wealth and consumption patterns make more of a difference when it comes to emissions than the absolute number of people.
And consumption is definitely not going down.
As societies become more affluent, the energy consumption in countries in Africa and Asia are going to significantly increase over the next 2 to 3 decades. And so the challenge is, how do we provide that additional energy requirements without increasing our carbon emissions?
India, for example, has experienced a massive economic boom since its economy opened up.
And the boom is set to continue. Rajesh Joshi in Delhi might soon be surrounded by even more traffic and delivery boys zipping around with packages.
So according to this projection, India's middle class will grow rapidly from 80 million to 580 million by 2025. And it will have serious consequences.
That's huge.
Yes, very, very huge.
Different parts of the world now have different challenges.
Developed nations, whose populations have for decades relied on carbon-intensive technologies for their way of life, have to find a way to step back and decouple how they live from the greenhouse gases it produces.
For the developing world, the question is how they grow, find happiness, without adding to emissions.
Niavani tells this story. Years ago, she took part in a project at a university in England.
They were asking for people to design and conduct research on the future cities and the way we are going to live in future, which is sustainable.
In the first meeting, a colleague from the engineering department got up and drew a picture of his idea.
And when I looked at this diagram, I laughed because, one, it was a small hut with a thatched roof. There was a bicycle outside. And most people were sort of like outside and then, you know, growing vegetables and there like that. It just looked like my village. So essentially, that's the future. And to get us to understand that and to appreciate that, I think is the challenge. Because at the moment, people just want high-rise buildings. They want big cars, etc. Because to them, that's prosperity.
Redefining prosperity. No big challenge there.
I mean, how do you think Malawi can encourage people towards a different lifestyle? Is it just going to be you standing there and be like, we're already in the future, look around you? Is that your plan?
Actually, I think I'm going to have a T-shirt made that says, the future is ours. We are already in the future. I think I'm going to have a T-shirt made because the more I think about it, you know, we need to carry on with the messages.
Listeners asked what population has to do with climate change. We've heard that population is a factor, but another one, consumption, might be having an even bigger impact. And while population growth rates are slowing, consumption rates are not.
In places where the population is growing quickly, such as Malawi, officials have put the issue into their climate plans, not as a way to lower their emissions, but instead to cope with the effects of rising temperatures.
We've also heard that who's talking about population matters.
To put it bluntly, people in the developing world, areas which have done nothing to create the climate crisis, don't want to be told by people in areas that did how many kids they should have.
All right, that music means it's time to talk about what's going on in the news. And of course, there's only one story in town, COP27, the big annual global climate conference that's kicking off right now. What a time for it. Since the last one in Glasgow, we've seen temperature records fall all over the world, with devastating heat waves from China to India, Europe to North Africa. And this year's big conference is being held in North Africa, Egypt to be precise. And our very own Jordan Dunbar is going to be there.
Yes, Neil, absolutely. 30,000 politicians, scientists, journalists, activists, business people, and me in one conference centre in the Red Sea.
And I suppose what's important is out of those 30,000 people will be people like Joe Biden, you know, leaders of major countries, people with power, presumably, to make change.
Yeah. So it really is a big hope and one of the few times when all of these people get together just to concentrate on climate change.
Now, Egypt, it's hosting this conference and it is billing it as Africa's COP. What do we know? How will that change the tone of things compared to last year?
Well, Neil, just give me a second here. I'm just checking around for the $100 billion that was promised back in 2009 to the Global South that was meant to be delivered by 2020. Still hasn't arrived. So because this COP is in the Global South, I imagine this is going to be really high on the agenda. Where is the money?
So there will be pressure, presumably, on the likes of Joe Biden and the other rich country leaders to pony up.
Yeah, and whether we're going to see an agreement on that. So there's a phrase, loss or damage. This is the idea that rich global north countries who have polluted most and made money from that pollution, they should be giving money to the global south, to countries that have polluted least but are experiencing some of the worst effects. So they're saying, you've profited from this, we should have a transfer of money. But there's a phrase that's being used, compensation, reparations, which makes it really politically difficult for those rich countries to get that passed with their voters. I don't know how far we're going to get on this.
And it's not necessarily like direct aid, but it's somehow unlocking the mechanism so the private sector can also help fund private programs that can help prepare people for the coming storms.
And that is also why you will have hundreds, if not thousands, of people from the finance industry. And governments also will be sending their finance people too, because it's going to be such a massive part, because everything we need to do, it all requires money.
Egypt's been a controversial choice as host for this conference. The right to protest there is severely restricted, but we also note that protest is an annual part of these COP conferences. What do we know about how people will be able to participate in this conference?
Well, there's going to be a zone set aside. So at COP, you have something called the Blue Zone, which is where the big talks are, and that's where you'll have the big world leaders. Then there's a green zone where you've got businesses, arts and activists. And within that green zone, there's going to be a place where civil society can get involved. But it's not the same as Glasgow last year. It's a big, huge city. You could spill out onto the streets. There were noisy protests everywhere. This is a resort town in the desert on the Red Sea. So it will be different from last year.
Yeah, I've heard the Egyptian government say, yes, we have these areas where you can protest, but the implication is that everywhere else you can't. And I know that there have been calls for wider climate-related protests during the conference and that this is a particularly sensitive issue there.
Yeah, and even last year in Glasgow, a lot of activists saying, even if they can protest outside, if they're not in the room, if they're not in the blue zone, if they're not where these big sessions are taking place, what's the point? Are they actually being heard, particularly young people? So it'll be interesting to see this year how youth is brought into those negotiations.
Jordan, I'll confess, I'm a bit jealous. I hope you have a great trip and look forward to talking to you from there.
And before we go, just a reminder that we love hearing your ideas for the programme. You can email us theclimatequestion, all one word, at bbc.com. That's theclimatequestion at bbc.com. It's a safe space for all those questions about the climate that you don't really want to ask your friends. Looking forward to hearing from you. But that is, I'm afraid, all we've got time for on this week's show. Thanks to our producer, Darren Graham, our researcher, Natasha Fernandez, series producer, Alex Lewis, and the man who makes the mix, Tom Brignall.
Hi, I'm Kalki Kekla, and I am back for Season 3 of My Indian Life, the podcast that brings you real-life stories from young people living all across this vast land.
So as a tribe, in our worldview, we are not mere part of nature, but we are nature.
Each week, we take a walk in our guests' shoes as they share their unique perspectives on living life in 21st century India. From the woman who works as a private investigator.
Who else would you go to? You can't follow the person yourself because you'll be very visible to the eye. You can't go to the police because police's work is not this. So it's us.
To the actress who has become a champion for body positivity.
How often do girls who look like me get offered lead roles? So that was my main thing. I thought I'm going to play this protagonist and I'm going to act the hell out of it.
That's Kalki Presents My Indian Life from the BBC World Service. Just search for My Indian Life wherever you found this podcast.
This week on the podcast Spark and Fire, Pixar director Domi Shi.
Oh no, maybe this is too weird and edgy for Pixar.
To hone her unique creative voice, Domi had to embrace her inner weirdo.
Combining Taoist chanting with 90s boy band music, it had to work.
On Spark and Fire, creators from different fields share their stories to fuel your creativity. Spark and Fire is a Wait What original in partnership with the BBC. Follow us wherever you get your podcasts.